Hi, this is James Barris. I hope you find this talk supports you in your practice. If you'd like to support my teaching, you can use the donate button underneath my picture on Dharma Seed to do that. Your support is greatly appreciated.
That was a big day today, wasn't it? It's actually an auspicious day today. I don't know if people are keeping track, but today is leap year day. Today is February 29th. We got an extra day. Did it feel like that? What an interesting concept. Oh, there's an extra day. Probably didn't feel any different, but it is leap day, and I just wanted to acknowledge that. And it's also a day of shifting the energy here for everyone. So I wanted to give a talk that would be relevant to both those who are leaving in a couple of days and those who are continuing for another month. And I thought I'd talk about applying our practice to a deep acceptance, lived acceptance of anicca, particularly with regard to transitions. Because we're all going through a transition, including the teaching team, too. And the one-monthers, that's a major shift. Beginning to talk, soon leaving the refuge of being here and thinking about going out into your daily life. And here we had this protected, minimal stimuli environment, held in the lap of the Dharma, and all these beautiful, wholesome conditions of support, and things change. So you probably have had these last days or so, maybe even leaning forward with anticipation or with reluctance, trepidation, and that's part of the process, but we're still here right now. The beginning of a retreat, it's, oh, what did I leave at home, and did I shut everything off? In the middle of the retreat, it's, oh, what's for lunch? And toward the end of the retreat, it's, oh, going home. You know, that's where the mind often goes. And you're probably in that process in your mind. And certainly after doing a little bit of interaction today. And for the continuing yogis, there's also a big transition. You could probably feel or sense, oh, not everybody is here when you did your Brahmavihara this afternoon. And imagining all the energy down there. And there's the outflow of energy that's going to be experienced in this next day or two, and the inflow of energy, people who haven't been sitting for a month coming in, and that's a whole adjustment in itself, along with another teaching team. So whether or not you're staying or you're going, you're in transition right now. And we get so still and kind of in the flow and in the routine after a month of sitting, then when there is a shift, it changes not only externally, but internally. It's quite common. For the for the people who are leaving, I just remember my earlier days of ending retreats, and I was not looking forward to letting go of my mindfulness. And just kind of like fought it and just wanting to squeeze the last moment of clarity, knowing that it wasn't going to be there very much longer. And I just braced myself and, okay, I'll talk. But it was really a drag, because I was bracing myself, and then it became that reverberation was strong. And then I started to figure out, after a little while, oh, there's a whole art in letting go of what was and opening up to the new reality. So I just first ask, you know, how are you relating to the change today and about to come? Are you excited about it? Are you putting the brakes on? Are you bracing yourself? These next 2 days, which is one of the main things I want to share with you, these next 2 days can be a very rich period of practice. Because for those who are leaving, you've built up that momentum, and you can see so much of the common habits of anticipation or reluctance. And you can learn, as I said, you can learn a lot. And those who are staying, you can also learn a lot about riding the waves, whatever waves there are. In our own practice, perhaps you've seen this in your practice, but transitions are usually the time where we most easily tend to slip out. Even like from one breath to another, if that's your primary object, from, you know, the in-breath to the out-breath, and there's a little pause often in the out-breath, and that's a place where the mind can tend to slip out, just in that transition. But in our practice in changing activities, there's the sitting, there's the walking, and it's those in-between times that we tend to get lost or just wander off. That's why continuity is so powerful. It's the key for me. It's the key to deepening practice. And I shared with you that teaching from Upandita, who gave 3 hours of talks on going from sitting up to your getting your shoes and going to walk, because it's so such a rich area to refine in your practice. And so then at some point I became really focused on the in-between times, brushing my teeth, showering, which for quite some time, how do you stay mindful in the shower? Now I'm actually mindful at home in the shower because I've just attended to it so much. Just think, when for you do you tend to slip out? Those in-between times, those transition times. And what would it be like to just give a little bit more curiosity and interest to see if it can be a kind of seamless dance of your day? In our daily life, we tend to also slip out, space out in those in-between times. You know, often because we're not giving ourselves enough time to make that transition in a mindful and a skillful way. And so we find ourselves hurrying to the next thing. And hurrying is, it's not conducive to mindfulness. And if you can kind of make it, again, just like here in the retreat, practice it at home, then every moment counts. And rather than trying hard to make it like a game, oh, let's see how I can do this. How present can I be for those getting in my car or turning on the ignition that Thich Nhat Hanh got to. If I get in my car, if I go fast, the car goes fast. Oh, just reminding yourself to be here. So it might not be so obvious, but we're always in transition. Always. From one breath to the next, from one step to the next, besides the more obvious changes, we're always in transition. And to see that way, that things are always changing, the Buddha said, is really the doorway to freedom. There's this one sutta that I particularly enjoy. I'll just mention it here because it comes down to stressing this point. It's called the Maggia Sutta. I don't know, has it been mentioned here yet? No. The Maggia Sutta, about this young guy who was an attendant. He happened to be assigned to be the Buddha's attendant, and the two of them were by themselves out in the forest. And Maggia was really into practice. I mean, if I was the Buddha's attendant, I'd be into being the attendant, but he was really strong on practice. He probably was enjoying being the Buddha's attendant. But on his alms round, he sees this fabulous mango grove, and he says, what a great place to practice. So he goes back to the Buddha, and he says, sir, I have found this really perfect, ideal condition for practicing. Can I go and do my practice? And the Buddha senses this guy is really new, and so he politely says, you know, we're here alone. I'm here all by myself, just the two of us. Why don't you just keep me company until others come? Maggia says, but sir, I really have an urge to practice. Again, the Buddha says, they'll be back. They'll be around soon. Just why not? Let's spend some time. And he asks the proverbial third time, and he says, sir, you've done what you've needed to do. I still need to practice. This is the Pali word chutzpah. translated as nerve. And you ask three times, the Buddha says, now is the time to do as you see fit. So go ahead and you practice. So Maggia goes and practices in the mango grove, and lo and behold, he sits and his mind is besieged by three main kinds of thought. Thoughts of sense desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. Those are the big three. And he's amazed. He goes back to the Buddha, and I'm kind of putting in my own words here, but kind of like, you'll never guess what happened. In the sutta says, how amazing, how incredible. I who've gone forward to the homeless, to the homeless life, with real sincerity, I've sat in that mango grove, sir, and my mind was besieged by these three kinds of thought. Isn't it amazing? And the Buddha says, yes, that can sometimes happen when your practice isn't really strong, has some more maturing to do. And then he gives him five supports for practice, which particularly for those who are going home, I often give this as a last instructions, the Buddha's instructions on keeping your practice strong. But there's a point about this topic that I want to end up with. So five supports when your practice isn't strong. This is what he says to Meghia. First support, having good friends, the whole of the holy life. And you could probably attest to the power of Sangha in sitting here together this month. Second support, to keep sila, act with integrity, and to really let that be the foundation. That's what the Buddha said. Sila is the foundation of inner peace. So keeping sila and integrity. Third support, being careful with your speech. So even though it's one of the five precepts, he underscores that. He says, watch your speech, because that will condition your mind a lot. Fourth support, we've spoken about this, is around wise effort, trying to weaken the unwholesome states, akusala, and strengthen, cultivate, and even maintain and increase the wholesome states. And then he says, fifth support, keep reflecting on impermanence. He says, if there's one ongoing reflection to remember, keep reflecting on impermanence. Because when you're having not just a concept, oh yeah, things change, but more and more an embodied experience, which you are all developing and strengthening in this month, you have noticed that things change, haven't you? The more you have an embodied understanding of it from one moment to another, then out in your life, when things are difficult, there's this trust. Sooner or later, things will change. I will smile again and laugh again. And while I'm in this space, let me learn what I can from it instead of being afraid it won't change. And when things are wonderful, if you remember that things change, to not be so surprised when they do. So he says, keep reflecting on impermanence. His advice to Meghia. This is the Buddha. The perceiving of impermanence, practitioners developed and frequently practiced, removes all sensual attachment, removes all attachment for material existence, removes all grasping for becoming, removes all ignorance, removes and abolishes all conceit of I am. So you've heard talks in this month on impermanence already, and we've referred to it over and over, and probably in your practice discussions too. This is where the rubber meets the road. To let go of what is or what was, and to not just accept, resign ourselves to reality, but to embrace reality. This is the movement from the second noble truth, the cause of suffering is attachment, to the third noble truth, the end of suffering. There is an end to suffering, which is all about letting go, and letting go what you cannot control. And what you cannot control is the unfolding of reality in the face of change, always changing. So grasping at the future, not being seduced by becoming, for those who might be leaving, just noticing the thoughts, which are quite understandable. Oh, when I go home, you know, I wonder how it's going to be. Or planning and rehearsing. And planning is a good thing. It's very good to plan. But once you plan, you don't want to keep on planning some more over what you've already planned. That's just going around and around and around. So it's good to plan, but then kind of see what happens. I forget if I mentioned it, the problem with worrying, that you're just in a feedback loop and a rut in your mind, and you can't meet the moment because you're thinking about the next moment. You can't meet it as wisely as otherwise you might have. We're trying to hold on to what is. Oh, do I have to go home? Or for those who are staying, you know, gosh, I wonder what this next month is going to be like. An understandable thought, but it's happening right now, so you might as well be here for this one. So I'm going to talk a little bit about transitions in relation to letting go. Ajahn Chah's main teaching, letting go. You've heard that one. Let go a little, you'll have a little freedom. Let go a lot, you'll have a lot of freedom. Let go completely, you'll have complete freedom. Your troubles with the world will come to an end. It's all about letting go. And he has this, you probably have heard this, this teaching on somebody asking him, what's this practice all about? And he picks up his cup and he says, you see this cup? It was given to me and made with a lot of love, and I enjoy it. It functions well. If I can see this cup is already broken, that's what this practice is about. I have a friend who really got this practice, literally. This is a few months ago. I have a dear friend, Edward Lewis, who was a very key person in the development of Spirit Rock almost 40 years ago. And he was one of the project manager. He was on the board, and he was a very key figure. He's now 88 years old, and he lives in Thailand, spends a lot of time with Ajahn Sumedho when Ajahn Sumedho is there. And he's in a group that I'm in, that's been meeting for about 13 years. We meet monthly. And on his 88th birthday, we asked him to give a Dharma talk of what he's learned in all of these years. And he had one beautiful teaching, among other things. He said, well, you know what? Last week, he's getting a bit older and frailer. Last week, I knocked over a vase, a fairly expensive vase. And he said, most of my life, my reaction would have been, oh, no. And when it happened, my reaction was, oh. Just missing that word, that's worth 40 years of practice. From, oh no, to, oh, ha, can you hear the relief in that? I thought that was one of the best Dharma talks I've heard in a long time. This is Ajahn Sumedho, this quote, maybe some of you have heard, on letting go. Ajahn Sumedho, I've mentioned him before, the senior Western Dharma heir to Ajahn Chah. He says, the practice of letting go is very effective for minds obsessed by compulsive thinking. You simplify your meditation practice down to just two words, let go, rather than try to develop this practice and then develop that and achieve this and go into that and understand this and read the suttas and study the Abhidhamma and then learn Pali and Sanskrit, then the Madhyamaka and the Prajnaparamita, get ordinations in the Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, write books and become a world-renowned authority on Buddhism. Instead of becoming the world expert on Buddhism and being invited to great international Buddhist conferences, just let go, let go, let go. I did nothing but this for about 2 years. Every time I tried to understand or figure things out, I'd say, let go, let go, until the desire would fade out. So I'm making it very simple for you to save you from getting caught in incredible amounts of suffering. There's nothing more sorrowful than having to attend international Buddhist conferences. Just let go. Let go of how you think it's going to be. Let go of what was. And just be here right now. I want to share another brilliant teaching about just being here right now instead of past or future. This is from Alan Watts, that brilliant Dharma transmitter. He says, we could say that meditation doesn't have a reason or doesn't have a purpose. In this respect, it's unlike almost all other things we do, except perhaps making music and dancing. When we make music, we don't do it in order to reach a certain point, such as the end of the composition. If that were the purpose of music, then obviously the fastest players would be the best. Also, when we're dancing, we're not aiming to arrive at a particular place on the floor as in a journey. When we dance, the journey itself is the point. As when we play music, the playing itself is the point. And exactly the same thing is true in meditation. Meditation is the discovery that the point of life is always arrived at in the immediate moment. If you meditate for an ulterior motive, that is to say, to improve your mind, to improve your character, to be more efficient in life, you've got your eye on the future and you're not really meditating. The future is a concept. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing as tomorrow. There never will be because time is always now. That's one of the things we discover when we stop talking to ourselves and stop thinking. We find there is only a present, only an eternal now. One meditates for no reason at all, except for the enjoyment of it. Here I would interpose an essential principle that meditation is supposed to be fun. It's not something you do as a grim duty. The trouble with religion today is that it is so mixed up with grim duties. You do it because it's good for you. It's a kind of self-punishment. Meditation, when correctly done, has nothing to do with all that. It's a kind of digging the present, a kind of delighting in the eternal now. It brings us into a state of peace where we can understand that the point of life, the place where it's at, is simply here and now. Alan Watts. So, as part of this offering about letting go, I thought I would have us explore the five remembrances, which is the Buddha's teachings on practicing impermanence all the time. And this is five things that he said to contemplate every day. The Upajjhatana Sutta, subjects for contemplation. You've heard these, but let's just take them on as a practice. I was part of a program called the Heavenly Messenger Program here at Spirit Rock. It was a 2-year program. I really enjoyed it, and people still get together who went through that program together. I did it with Frank Ostaseski and Sharda Rogel and Bob Stahl, Angie Stevens. And we looked at these first three of these contemplations are the Heavenly Messengers, and then there's two more. And it was really powerful. It was powerful for me to have to, it's always good to practice what you're teaching. So I took it on as a practice. Okay, let's just really work with this. And the first one, I am not beyond aging. I am subject to old age. This body is not beyond aging. As the Buddha says in his sutta, in reflecting on aging, beings are intoxicated with youth. And this culture glorifies youth. Is it possible to hold aging in a different way than, inevitable resignation? I think it is. And to play around with that possibility, aging isn't easy, but it can be a very rich period in life. And this is from the founder of the Live Oak Project, Barry Barkin, on another way to hold the process of aging. That is his definition of an elder. An elder, he says, is a person who is still growing, still a learner, still with potential, and whose life continues to have within it promise for and connection to the future and being alive. An elder can still enjoy happiness and joy, and their birthright to these remains intact. Moreover, an elder is a person who deserves respect and honor, and whose work it is to synthesize wisdom from a long life experience and formulate this into a legacy for future generations. What a good way to go into elderhood. Very different from what our culture usually does. And in most indigenous cultures, the elders are honored, have the highest place of honor. Is all the wisdom that they've accumulated and all that they've done for the community. So I just ask you, this is from Zalman Schachter, who was a pioneer in conscious aging. He wrote a book, From Aging to Saging. And he asks to reflect, and I just invite you to reflect for a moment. What are your feelings about aging? What do you fear about aging? do you or might you look forward to about aging? About that natural transition? Is there a way to hold it so that more than just acceptance and embracing, because this is the way things are, this is part of life. And I invite you to have the most inspiring vision for yourself of what it would be like to age gracefully, as the phrase goes, but really to age gracefully. How inspiring that would be for others. And you probably know, I'm sure we all know, inspirations of people who embody that, who are so worthy of honoring and respect. Okay. On to the second contemplation. This body will become ill. I am not beyond illness. So many of us, and probably people here or people that you know, have deepened their practice and their wisdom and their compassion through illness. Coming close to death really wakes us up, or seeing how fragile this body-mind process is. But we can have a whole different way of relating to it. A friend of mine, a good friend on the East Coast, has just gone through 2 years dealing with throat cancer, which is a very difficult kind of cancer. And she gave her first Dharma talk last month, actually. And she sent me the Dharma talk. She gave it to her Sangha. It was so powerful. Just beyond the words, the spirit and the accumulation of wisdom that she gained going through this. We had a beautiful conversation about it, and she was wise to begin with, but she had a whole other level that she was able to glean from it. This is a good friend of ours, friend who I mentioned, I think, who does gratitude emails with my wife, Jane, for many years. And she also went through the breast cancer journey. And she'd been doing gratitude practice for a number of years. And this is what she writes. The second round of chemo has been difficult, but I don't add to the difficulty. What I feel most is gratitude. I cry now just feeling this. I'm perhaps more aware than ever of the suffering in the world. Yet when I woke up the other day and looked at the full moon through the skylight, clouds surrounding it, deeply moving to cover it, life. She did get through the cancer a number of years ago, but how to use that inevitable experience that we will all go through, this body is not beyond illness, how to use it to deepen our practice and to open up and again, embrace reality, to let go of what was and see how I can transform what is for my deepening. This is from Ram Dass, who, as probably all of you know, had a major stroke in 1997 when he was, I think, 60, in his 60s. And it took him a while to get used to that transition, and I knew him through that transition. And it was hard for a while, very hard, but then he was so clear he wanted to use this as practice. And this is what he writes in his book, Still Here. I used to say I'm a golfer and a sports car driver, but now I'm someone telling that story. I can't golf or drive anymore. And if I cling to that identity, I suffer. The stroke was like a samurai sword cutting apart the two halves of my life. It was a demarcation between two stages. Before I had the stroke, I was full of fears about aging. The stroke took me through one of my deep fears, and I'm here to report that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. The stroke cleaned out some of the pockets of fear. It's happened, and here I am. And the result, as Ram Dass said and wrote, is that he grew closer to God than ever. He says, what more could I ask? And seeing him go through that transformation, I knew him from before and after. And those last 20 years, he just became lighter and lighter as his body was more and more going downhill. His spirit just became lighter and lighter. It was really a remarkable deepening of his practice. So let me ask, if and when you experience illness, and maybe you are now, or maybe you're going through something at this point, how can you use it in a way that deepens your practice? That deepens your compassion, deepens your understanding of the human condition. And just envision that as a possibility. Okay. Now we'll go to the next of the contemplations. This body will die. I am not beyond death. And to contemplate death as a practice, the Buddha said, think of this not just every now and then, not just every day, not just every hour. He says in one discourse, be aware in every breath. He doesn't say that to become morbid or depress you. He's saying, just be aware of how precious each moment is. And the more we can get used to and allow for this natural unfolding to happen, the less we're afraid of it. I encourage you, and I have many times just imagined, rehearsed my death. What would it be like? Who knows what it will be like, but just rehearsing it gives you some possibility. Can I let go gracefully into the mystery when it's my turn, and it will be everyone's turn? again, another friend of ours, Don Flaxman, who was the he was the chairman of the board of Spirit Rock for a number of years in the early years. Really wise man and a good friend. And he had also incurable cancer towards the end, but all his practice really bore fruit. And he shared the diagnosis, he shared his with me, and I was really moved by his acceptance of the situation, not only acceptance, but how he turned it into an opportunity to deepen his love of life. And this is what he told me. I wrote it down. I'm now in the richest period of my life. Now that I have less time, I'm more open than I've ever been. I'm amazed at how much joy is available just by smelling a pretty flower, seeing a hummingbird, or hearing a friend's voice. I don't waste my time complaining. Expressing love and gratitude is the most important thing I can do now. And another dear friend who I've been very inspired by, a wonderful teacher and friend, Terry Patton, who passed away about three years or so ago. On his 70th birthday, when he was in the peak of health, of good health, he was given a diagnosis that he had an incurable condition. And 7 months later, he did die. And he gave these series of talks that I love on his own mortality and on the society's possible mortality. He was very, very concerned about climate and where we were heading. And on the last talk, which was taped, they were all taped, but his last talk, which was given a week before he died, and I have a video clip of it, somebody asked him, how are you feeling about this? Are you, is it scary? Are you resisting? And he said, sure, there's, you know, I don't want to go. But then he said something that has stayed with me since I heard it. He said, I don't want to, in the time I have left, I don't want to waste my time being in resistance to reality. Reality wins every time. And my task, I am ennobled by learning to embrace it. So that's something to just consider. Why waste our time being in resistance to reality? Reality wins every time. So you can either be in resistance and wish it were not so, or rise in your practice and say, as Ajahn Sumedho would say, it's like this. And now how can I relate wisely to that? Let's see. And then there's loss, the fourth of these contemplations. Everything and everyone near and dear to me, I will be separated from. And that's, and sometimes, well, that's the hardest. Oh, I have to let go of this person and that person and that person, or this, whatever the loss is. Just think, how many best friends have you had in your life? You might, sometimes you're best friends with your best friend in childhood. Anybody who's best friends with their best friend that they grew up with? Just a couple. But for everyone else, you've had best friends that you thought, I could never let go of this relationship. How many best friends have you had that you've survived and on to another best friend? And then there's the loss of those really dear to us. I don't have time to share some stories, but everybody who's been close to us, who we lose because of the natural order of things, there is a healthy grieving process, and there is also a kind of integration process where they become more and more who we are. They live through us, all the beautiful qualities that we've experienced through from them live through us. And there's a whole beautiful art in transforming the grief into honoring and celebration. The Japanese have a concept, wabi-sabi, which is the poignancy of impermanence. The notion is called wabi-sabi life. Like the cherry blossom, it is beautiful because of its impermanence, not in spite of it, more exquisite for the inevitability of loss. So you don't want to miss out or take for granted those who are precious to us while we're here. Don't wait until the memorial service to remember how dear they are to you. Be with it in their living connection to you. And then the fifth is, you are the owner of your karma. Your actions and habits and choices are your true belongings. So that is, given the fact that everything is changing and there is aging, illness, death, loss, how are you going to live your life? Are you going to live it trying to hold on and resist reality? Or can you meet it with grace and wisdom and compassion and a deepening of your awakening? We are always in transition, and transition can be seen as continual transformation, because when we reflect on impermanence, sometimes there's this sense of loss and, oh, do I have to let go of this and this and this? But the other side of impermanence is infinite creativity. There's always a new moment. Have you noticed? What's gone is gone. What's here now? It's never been here before. So it's possible, and I would encourage as you go through these next couple of days, besides the letting go and the natural, whatever grieving there is and saying goodbye to your refuge or to the your dharma, your yogi friends, if you're staying here, it's, oh, here's a new adventure in store for me. Just a whole other way to hold it instead of losing infinite creativity. And as much as we can to develop this quality of equanimity, which we've been exploring these last days, equanimity is the key to going through change and going through whatever transition you're going through. It's all coming and going, coming and going. And can I meet each moment fresh and centered? And the more you can learn in these obvious changes that we're all going through, the more you can bring that into your life. It's okay. Everything is changing, and it's okay. So I'll end with a passage that I love on these cycles from Be Here Now, my Bible. This is called the Course of Sadhana, or sadhana is spiritual practice. There is, in addition to the up and down cycles, an in and out cycle. That is, there are stages at which you feel pulled to inner work, and all you seek is a quiet place to meditate and to get on with it. Then there are times when you turn outward and seek to be involved in the marketplace. Both of these parts of the cycle are a part of one's sadhana, one's practice. For what happens to you in the marketplace helps in your meditation, and what happens to you in meditation helps you to participate in the marketplace without attachment. What is happening to you is nothing less than death and rebirth. What is dying is the entire way in which you understood who you are and how it all is. What is being reborn is the child of the spirit for whom things all are new. This process of attending to an ego that is dying at the same time as you're going through a birth process is awesome. Be gentle and honor that which is dying as well as that which is being born. So let's sit for a few moments. Thank you very much for your attention. So once again, there'll be a chanting and sitting, and I'll share another little extra treat for the end. So come and sit with us. Yeah. Enjoy your walking.